In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. We go now to hear the second part of the interview with Dr. Paulo Correa. He's finishing an answer to the question related to discussing what is needed for cold fusion energy to be successfully created for practical use. As you'll hear, there is a path forward, and it requires scientists to learn about etherometry, to find errors in it, and improve upon it along the way. Otherwise, Dr. Correa says, we'll be spinning our wheels and wasting hundreds of millions, if not billions, of taxpayer funds. We go now to hear part two of the interview with Dr. Paulo Correa.
For instance, so collection at a distance, a mystical thing, as if there was some kind of induction at a distance that didn't involve transfer of energy. And likewise, you know, concepts that are demonstrably false, like those of neg entropy, they exist because the concept of entropy as it exists is also demonstrably false. So as long as, you know, science and its disciplines, particularly the physical disciplines, are so caught up in these errors and spinning their wheels in them, certainly no forward path can be seen. Any forward path, in my view, will have to pass by scientists, not just physicists, learning through metric methods and even finding errors in etherometry. That's fine with me, especially if it's found, they are found with etherometric methods that will be the cat's meow. No theory is eternal and fixed and final. But there is a whole new framework with which to operate. And unless scientists and physicists make an effort to actually get acquainted and operate in that framework, there will be no progress. When it comes to the larger question that you're raising, it obviously does not just depend on where do states or governments and corporations put their capital. Of course, that makes a huge difference since it rules the world. But they also put it where they put it because the populations, various peoples and cultures are completely divorced from their own everyday reality and the world around them. They actually, I mean, even the Greens, they destroy things. They don't have any appreciation for nature, ecology. I remember, you know, when we were young and hopeful, there was a big meeting before this global warming business became, you know, statutory dogma, was the meeting in Rio in 1997. My team at the time made a huge effort to have a presence down there. We sent staff to all sorts of organizations, from Greenpeace down to the smallest groups that were enrolled in this United Nations initiative. And we did not succeed to get a single one of our posters and communications posted to this meeting. And we complained, of course, we denounced. But right there we knew that all of these green gimmicks can only turn in sort of, you know, a more micromanaged form of fascism, and that the militants who are involved in them, aside from being idiots and fanatics, really don't understand nothing whatsoever about physics, science, the real problems. That entire story, we debunked it, I don't know if you've read it, on two pieces that we wrote about global warming back in 2005. That are fully accessible in the etherometry.com website that you mentioned. It's the metrics of the ether, etherometry. So it's ether plus O plus metry. We didn't want to abandon the concept of the ether just because since Maxwell in 19th century, it was so abusively assimilated to electromagnetic, at the time, waves, and later electromagnetic energy, whether, quote, in wave form or particle form, quantum form. And there it is. It's called Global Warming and Official Pseudoscience. Is the second entry in that publications in Politics of Science and Scientific Polemics, which we are no stranger to. If you look down that page, you can see how many polemics and how many articles we wrote on this subject, because at the end of the day, physics and science do devolve back to the strategies of power. So there's an innate and inherent politics to science, you know.
Well, Dr. Correa, your answer does have some hopelessness in it, but I understand you're being very, very honest and critical here, as it should be, because this is, you know, the future of society, mankind, we'll say. Some of these concepts are very, very complex. And so for most people, like myself, I wouldn't know if I'm getting led down the wrong path of science and physics. I wouldn't know. I would say, oh, we can't figure it out. I would certainly know that there was something involved preventing it, and if nothing happened over time. But I think, you know, for most people, we're trusting these scientists to do the right thing. And you're saying a lot of these scientists don't even recognize the fundamental flaws. So I appreciate you going into that.
Well, for sure. That is part, that's actually, that's part of the epoch. So the general answer to your question, it's really what Dr. Wilhelm Reich would have called the character structure of our epoch. Perhaps a bit deeper than what the term character structure was meant to be. Because at the end of the day, what is it that prevents people from living fully their lives? It's not just that the nature of the power, social institutions of power around them are largely limitative and preventive, but it's also the lack of desire to learn and imagination to change things and confront problems in their lives. So, you know, that's beyond heterometry. The limitations of our present-day researchers, they're limitations of an epoch shared with the largest masses of the planet. And, you know, these masses have a desire to live to some extent in subjection and to be deluded by the lies that the ministries of propaganda that today are so insidious and present as veritable armies of programmed bots and AI bots in social media. And people are eager to swallow this stuff, to believe in it. They are eager to believe it more as they are not eager to learn. That is the problem. And the reason why they are not eager to learn is because they perceive, you know, learning as being, one, worthless, as an expenditure of time that will lead nowhere. Well, there's truth in that, because to learn false science is no better than to learn the ridiculous rituals and notions of any mass religion. So people get lost. They convince themselves to give up. And at the end of the day, you know, it cannot just be the scientists that suddenly, because they realize that there is all this other stuff that they have been missing and go and learn it with heterometric methods and so on. That won't be nowhere sufficient. And we are not in an age of revolution. If ever there was one, we are on age of, you know, irrational eruptions of violence that everywhere are typified by the most ridiculous, you know, issues and labels. And you know, the entire social and political discourse is very muddled. Part of it is because our epoch has actually never understood what was the real nature of fascism, never really understood what really is fascism and what is not. When the word is applied to anything and everything instinctively, it ceases to have any specific meaning. And so our age, you know, has done that, has, mixed things up to such an extent that it's not the night in which all cows are black, as Hegel so feared, but the night in which you can't see the cows because everything is foggy and gray. You know, they aren't even black, everything is gray. And the mind of most human beings lives in this gray zone, this fog zone. They all feel, particularly in our present-day society, that they are victimized one way or the other without realizing that the number one victimization is their self-victimization, is their, you know, lack of will to break through and free of the chains that they have inherited, which are everywhere in every one of our cultures. This is not a problem of the Western civilization. It's a problem of all the cultures of the planet, all types of civilizations that have survived to this day, even as they meld now into one gigantic mishmash, because it's not very clear what they are melding into. What is the global economy? Even that is unclear. But at the end of the day, I'm very individualistic, and I believe that unless the change occurs at an individual level, whether it is personal level or a community level, a collectivity that has an individuality, nothing is ever going to change, you know. I don't believe on changes that are brought from above, even though we are condemned to them, because they never lead anywhere other than to further mystification and confusion and further fuzziness. So we live in a very confused world today where nothing is clear, you know, nothing. No politics, no religion, no science. Everything looks like a bunch of ad hoc mixtures. And people fall into these holes instead of trying to sort themselves out. I don't know what else can I say to you, because at the end of the day, that's reflected on everything. It's reflected on the fact that no part of our social world actually wants to finance basic research for its own sake, you know. It should be science, science, gracia of science, by the grace of science, you know. Not science because the military wanted to interfere, not science because the politics thinks it should be this way or not. None of that has any value. And we can see that plainly enough with disasters of so-called, you know, green technologies, or the ridiculous conundrum that global warming and climate change myths have created. They suck all the energy of an epoch into this mythical, imaginary, and it's always a disaster scenario of one type or another. I mean, that goes without saying, because it's the politics of alarmism, of keeping people connected and in a state of anxiety. So there's a profound destruction of the spirit of human beings that our social world is, it's wreaking havoc with the minds and the lives of people. And how do you change that, you know?
Well, you did present some positive elements in your papers where you emphasized how, well, you know, the people who are bringing new ideas and mass-free energy ideas into development, do it for yourself. Do it in a group. Get it out to people as fast as possible. Maybe there is hope for some younger generations to pivot out of these repetitive climate change campaigns and into highlighting, you know, the work of inventors. It's just a matter of knowing which of these inventions and that this type of mass free energy development is going to work.
Yeah, but you know, I'm constantly receiving communications from people that claim they are young people, and or some that I know they are. You know, they mix the good with the bad, the shaft with the wheat, you know, in everything. They don't have any analytical powers of discrimination. And that's actually quite interesting, because it's obviously not enough to want to break out. you do have to make an effort to learn and confront what you're learning with your own thought and thought that others potentially might have emitted or written about whatever it is you're learning. So there's a whole dynamic here, which is, you know, autodidact, you know, it's self-teaching, that if you don't take the time to teach yourself, to learn by yourself, if your time is occupied with whatever, and whatever free time you have, you know, after your work, your family, and this and that, you spend it in entertainment, you just waste it away. You actually are not doing an investment in your own life or your own benefit. So there's, you know, like the Greeks had a very strong culture. I'm thinking about Athens and in classical days, that the young people valued, you know, they valued development, physical activity and gymnastics as much as they valued the development of intellectual abilities and perceiving powers, you know, you may say. Kids that grew up in such a society, they had a natural stimulation to learn, whether from teachers or from their own experience, if they looked at it analytically and pondered it. Today, there's nothing like that. In fact, most brains are wired. You talked about the digital xylem because people are wired to this stupid phone invention that started out with Graham Bell for such good purposes and ends up by being actually the worst nemesis of a free human being and a society that is, quote, open. So it's as closed and uniform as it could be. It's worse than the regimes of black fascism or red fascism. It's worse than anything that we have ever seen before. And yet is so insidious, so unnoticed, so completely embraced by everybody, you know, and it's addictive. So it replaces the thinking processes. You don't need to know anything. Everything is going to be on that cellular, on that smartphone, and it's smarter than you are, quote. That's the disaster, the cultural disaster here, that decoded all the cultures, but produced this, as you aptly say, digital xylem. What could be more constraining than that?
Well, Dr. Correa, thank you for answering that question. It was an abstract question, but I was very interested in your thoughts, since you're very critical in a range of disciplines. Dr. Correa, there was news recently about a French company making gains in the approach of cold fusion experimentation. They termed, quote, magnetic confinement fusion, a technique in which powerful magnetic fields hold plasma in a torus as it's heated until hydrogen begins to fuse. You've talked in past interviews here on In Other News about fundamental flaws within cold fusion experiments, and more bench work is needed for practicality. Would you please talk more about what is needed for cold fusion energy to be successfully created for practical use?
Well, let's just talk instead about hydrogen fusion. The official approach has been, basically since time of Dr. Teller, the approach that one calls thermonuclear. That fusion is a thermonuclear phenomenon. It's a matter of containing an hydrogen plasma by means that are either inertial or magnetic. Since confining it the way it's confined by stars, gravitationally, is not something that our technology can even dream of doing. So, you know, largely that's where the research carried on by governments and military since the Second World War has focused on. Now, it's a myth. Fusion, hydrogen fusion, cannot be simply achieved by just confining plasma by whatever methods, inertial, magnetic, and then infusing it with huge quantities of electromagnetic heat and see if this plasma can sustain what are called tremendous temperatures. So actually, first of all, there's the problem that our current work in thermodynamics and papers we have released recently show poignantly that the temperature scale that came out of the applications of quantum physics is grossly distorted. And when they talk about 180, 150 million degrees, doesn't matter if it's Kelvin, Fahrenheit or Celsius, you know, they're talking about temperatures that don't actually exist. We have demonstrated this even in our volume dedicated to the solar system, and several of the chapters or monographs of that volume, you know, focus on the errors that lead to this ridiculous notion. But the notion is further ridiculous because it subtends that it's only a question of pushing enough energy into a plasma. We're back to the Zitterbewegung to create, you know, sufficient randomistic oscillations for suddenly to, out of the blue, there will emerge an ordered plasma system that is generated by the fusion of hydrogen. Well, the fact is that this breakthrough of the French, which was a response to the breakthrough of the Chinese a month or so earlier, these are both of them thermonuclear reactors, they're called Tomahawks. It's a nothing burger, like the one before was a nothing burger. That they sustain for 15, 20 minutes, it doesn't matter how long, you know, a boiling plasma of hydrogen, it's not evidence of any fusion whatsoever. They didn't report fusion products. I mean, obviously, they probably did some mass spectroscopy. I don't doubt it. They should, if they're any good. But where are the reports for the actual physical evidence of this achieved fusion? And they don't claim they achieved fusion. All they claim is that they sustained a hydrogen plasma, a plasma of protons at temperatures that, as I'm saying, are not even real temperatures. So this is more smoke and mirrors, as we have had from the thermonuclear fusion community for the past 8 years. So it's really nothing new. Is, you know, every so on and off is a bit like the UFO fad, the UFO fad. Every so on and off, you know, they do a reinsufflation just to tell us that, you know, this thing is ongoing and it's worth keep on investing and put a lot of trillions of dollars of taxpayer into this completely asinine project, some of them. Now, fusion, obviously, hydrogen fusion exists. Now, our star, the Sun, is a good example of it. But as we showed in one of the papers we published 2 years ago, granted, we only give access to people to read this under NDA because it has a lot of information that military systems all over the world would like to have and understand. Because even having it, I mean, I just published actually the full reaction in this latest issue of the Journal of Heterometric Research. I doubt many physicists will be able to figure out what that full reaction really is telling them. But they should, if they had any intelligence. If really their grasp existed, they should figure out, wow, this is a real breakthrough here. And why is it a real breakthrough? Because we demonstrate in that paper, hydrogen fusion is not driven by any injection of electromagnetic energy. It's not driven by heat, it's not driven by light. And it does not result, when it's properly confined, if you will, it does not result in production of photons, whether they be light, heat, or even ionizing photons like gamma rays and X-rays and so on. So, in fact, the core of the Sun is dark. It doesn't generate neither heat nor light. All the heat and the light of the Sun is generated in the outer layers surrounding the core. The core is dark can be. The reaction proceeds with no loss that is electromagnetic in nature. So again, we're back to the same blindness of seeing photons, virtual or actual, and everything. And the resulting models, of course, are ineffectual. And so when you get to experiments, what are you going to... You're going to demonstrate that the thermonuclear pathway must have some validity. And you're going to say, well, you know, we sustained at 180 million degrees, we sustained this hot plasma of protons, you know, for 15 minutes, for 20 minutes, for whatever. That's evidence of nothing. Also, there is no cold fusion, because fusion is neither hot nor cold. hot and cold are properties that belong, in essence, to electromagnetic fields and electromagnetic energy. You know, part of our work on thermodynamics has been to separate so-called components that are responsible for the heat, the manifestation of heat in, let's say, an atmosphere, in a gas enclosure, or in solids and liquids. It makes no difference. Really, at the limit, all heat is electromagnetic. All heat is caused by actual and real photons, but is associated with forms of kinetic molecular energy that are particular. And so there is what one should call, and we have called, a thermokinetic molecular component to heat. That component cannot be transformed directly into mechanical work. The electromagnetic heat can, but not the thermokinetic heat. And so, even the nature of heat is poorly understood in thermodynamics, whether it's classic, quantum, or post-Prigogine. It makes no difference. The same mistakes, conceptual and functional, are still being worked on. And so there's no cold fusion, there's no hot fusion. There are different pathways for the fusion of hydrogen, but only one of those pathways is actually used by stars, including the Sun. Now, that's not to say that every star is the same pathway, because this pathway is the primary pathway. Many stars are very evolved along, you know, developmental paths, and they have already abandoned that more primary hydrogen fusion pathway, and they use other fusion pathways with much heavier elements being involved. But when we're talking about hydrogen fusion, then I must say what since 2001 I've been saying, and since 2005 with the publication of what we called provocatively the Korea solution to the cold fusion problem, it's a pathway that only involves electrodynamic control of the reaction, which in stars calls forth the gravitational containment. So one has to reproduce the effects of the gravitational containment by electrodynamic means. That's actually what we did in the nuclear reactors, the fusion reactors that we designed. We never got a chance to build one. We came very close to actually building one in parts, but that's a whole other story and why it failed. But, you know, the physics approach to the problem of fusion is totally flawed. And it has to be flawed, since, you know, conversions of neutrons into protons are supposed to be single events involving an electron and an electron neutrino. When we have demonstrated in one of the papers we published in 23 that all such conversions of protons into neutrons or neutrons back into protons are three electron steps and there is no neutrino involvement. We actually published two formal demonstrations of the non-existence of neutrinos. So it's that basic. The mistakes in nuclear physics are this basic. Here is not a question of learning geometry. It's a question of learning your mistakes. Why is it that there is not, you know, single electron reactions? And why all these reactions must occur in threes? That's nature, and it's a mistake that nuclear physicists continue to make, whether they are cold fusioners, quote, or, you know, official physicists that engage in teaching and quote-unquote demonstrating the existence of thermonuclear fusion. It's a pipe dream. It doesn't exist. There is neither a thermonuclear fusion nor a cold fusion. There's only hydrogen fusion.
Dr. Correa, thank you for again answering and going into detail on that issue, because that's something we talked about in a past interview. And you're consistent in the answer. You're right. A lot has not changed here. Dr. Eugene Malov became a good friend to you and your wife, Alexandra, for several years before he was murdered. He was 56. Dr. Malov was founder and president of the New Energy Foundation and editor-in-chief of its magazine, Infinite Energy. He was previously chief science writer at the MIT News Office. He also began to see the importance of etheric energy in relation to the current mass-free energy experiments. Please talk about why Dr. Maliff became interested in the work of etherometry.
Well, I met Eugene Maliff in 1996 at the ISNE3 in Colorado, the New Energy Conference. I think it was the third venue. I had given my first lecture disclosing the PhD on the physics of PhD. We were some hours later talking in a room for the press, and Eugene heard me explaining some details of my lecture to other physicists that were present, and then he asked me for a resume, and I gave him an abstract that lasted some 25 minutes. And Gene was completely taken by it. He sent people to check our measurements. Mike Carell came up, an old engineer from RCA, a guy who was debunker-in-chief and tester-in-chief, confirmed, you know, my results. And eventually, you know, Gene came to visit us very assiduously between 2000 and 2004. Even though we knew him for the last 8 years of his life, we became very, very close friends in the past 4 years of his life. In fact, Gene told me that we were the best friends he has ever had. He loved everybody, Alex, Mogoj. But he was, you know, particularly close friend to myself. You know, once he went through all the demonstrations, not just for the PhD at the time, but for the Tesla, Reich, so-called ether motor, and other inventions that we haven't even published about that had demonstrators all across our labs. You know, some of them very, very interesting. One that, for instance, shows how electric levitation in spinning rotors is possible just using a field means of acceleration. You know, and Gene wanted to stick his nose and his finger and everything open, every box. And we didn't have anything to hide. You know, he was under NDA anyway, and he was a physicist and a scientist. So, and a genuine fellow. He was not one of these posers, these fakes that, you know, come to our hands millions of times. And he became genuinely impressed. He learned the material. He realized the depth of the work that we had carried, not just on plasma physics, but in the foundations of a new approach to basic fundamental physics, etherometry. It was like that. Like, he would spend days in here, 2-3 days every visit, and there were so very many. They are all documented in this new website that we've released, which can be accessed at eugenemaliff.com, and that's eugenemaliff.com, culminating on the last few visits that he had, The last one was a month before he was murdered. We were in touch virtually every day, several emails, sometimes phone calls. It was actually a very demanding friendship at that point. And Gene was full of ideas. He wanted to be the person in charge of actually publicizing and the information about our work, about etherometry. And he was a part of our team, created a company in the States geared to sell our DVDs. He took it upon himself. He was a co-inventor of the first Iborac developments that he actually even wrote a patent application, which, you know, we abandoned for other reasons. And one day, I think it was, again, about 3 months or so before he was murdered, he came up here with a potential sponsor, and he spent 2 days. And on the first day, you know, he sort of wanted to understand why, in my view, so-called cold fusion didn't work, and why Lenner. And by then, we had discussed a variety of topics regarding the problems that exist for so-called low-energy nuclear reactions, the model that replaced the original cold fusion reaction that was proposed by Peter Hagelstein. I decided that I was going to give him this entire volume of The Heterometric Theory of Synchronicity, volume 4, which I have never published, but was completely written, and let him read it. Next thing that I know was that Gene spent the entire night in the lab reading it. He didn't sleep that night. Next morning he was beside himself because he was by then more than used to our work discoveries and quite familiar with, you know, our lab and measurement techniques and this and that we used. And so this really blew himself. His mind was in a state of complete alteration. He wanted us to publish this right away. And I have never published it, largely because of his murder, which basically made me see how, you know, recessive and retrogressive are human beings in our world, that they really don't deserve some of this knowledge. They are not capable of handling it one bit. But, you know, Gene was a forever optimist. Sometimes, actually, in later years, you'd say that it had been tempered by our friendship. He thought that I was sort of a forever pessimist. But I'm neither an optimist nor a pessimist, to be honest with you. But, you know, he was very excited, and he wanted us to publish it. And it was partially because of that when the Department of Energy report and the cold fusioners around Eggleston and McCubber and others, you know, made a proposal, it was really washed out. Their proposal was washed out, and the results were completely ridiculous, that I decided to expose the inherent limitations of their thought, their approach, and also the errors of their experiment. So this didn't sit very well, but I did it, largely because Gene had been so infused with enthusiasm regarding, you know, the necessity in his mind of having it released to the public and to the scientific community. Obviously, we only went part way because the Korea solution to the problem of nuclear physics was really, you know, focused on the DOE report and mistakes of what by then was almost, 15, 16 years of so-called cold fusion physics, you know. But we decided not to publish the volume of heterometry, of ATOS, Heterometric Theory of Synchronicity, that Gene read. And we have released parts of it 3 years ago when we published our volume on the solar system, which has astonished me how very few people have managed to read it, because I guess for most people, what NASA says is enough and the rest is passé. And yet, if one reads that volume that we wrote, one realizes how much is currently unknown about how the solar system and the star Sun work. It's just, and the data is all there to figure it properly, which is what we did. We used existing data to figure it out properly. And, of course, you know, to figure out a scheme for the evolutionary development of stars that is based on the correct approach to the physics of nuclear fusion. If you go to the site and you go home on the site, click home, and you have Journal of Heterometric Research on the right. And then if you click, there is a little index of the different volumes, volumes 1, 2, 3, and 4. And this paper is either in volume 2 or volume 1. Volume 1, number 3, the Korea solution to the cold fusion enigma. So if you click on that volume 1, the issue number 3 is that precise report that I was talking about.
Dr. Correa, I know this is a very sensitive topic. I'm not sure if anyone knows, but I didn't think that Dr. Maloff's murder was necessarily related to his work, but, you know, everyone has doubts. What are your thoughts now, looking back?
Well, at the time that it happened, it certainly was one of the main fears in our minds, and not just ours, but a lot of people around Gene. Gene was very involved with us as a partner, a member of society we had created. We had common interests, we had agreements in principle, he had stored a great deal of our confidential documents. But the fact that the investigation was so bungled up for the first, 5 or 6 years, that just added more mystery. When the family let me read the coroner's report, and I once taught anatomy and histology, I realized that this man had been put through a death of 1,000 knives, a torture that you don't even wish on your worst enemy. And of course, that by itself was very difficult to cope with, since we didn't know. Now, as it turns out, after many bungled investigations, eventually the state of Massachusetts came up with, you know, arresting who? In essence, the renter of Gene's parents' house and the people that lived in that house with the renter. This was, by all accounts, appears to have been 3 guys and a woman who were peddling drugs out of this place, had stopped paying rent to Gene. Gene had moved a process that led to a sheriff eviction from the locale. In fact, Gene had gone down there to clean the mess these people left behind, which was indescribable. Gene had seen it before, and he was going down on that day to clean it. And who does he find in that house? You know, these 4 monkeys, you know. These 4 apes, for lack of a better word. Nobody shall ever understand, but it's conceivable. What are you doing in here, dealing drugs of my place? You're long gone. You're supposed to be long gone, da-da-da. And, you know, these guys, two of them clearly gang-type people, which America is infested with these types. They did, with obviously some kind of involvement of the other two, the man and the woman, they did the unspeakable. And he was still alive by the time they abandoned him outside. I mean, it was really... Now, I'm not in favor of death penalty, especially administered by governments and states, my God. But here is one case that would have deserved the full... nevertheless, that's... They are all, as far as I can tell, they are all out and around. The woman had a baby of babies, and she made a deal with state and this and that. She became the basic witness anyway. I don't have much faith in all these investigations, given how long it took. Almost, 8 years passed before, quote-unquote, the truth was discovered. And I also don't put aside the possibility that these people had more of an animus for reasons that we shall never know. Whether they involve my work or not, I kind of doubt it, but who knows how cuckoo people think, you know, how they put things together in their minds. It's a mystery. But, no, I don't have any, you know, my inclination does not lie in that direction. What I know was that it was a terrible loss for me, a personal loss of a very deep friend and a very close friend. We shared so much together. So, and then a loss for our scientific endeavors and projects. And then for the world and for his family, of course. But for the world was a huge loss, because Gene had something that is very rare. He had the energy, the interest, the enthusiasm, and you would follow. These things were not spurious with him. He didn't, like a lot of people, they get enthusiastic about something, and then the moment they eat a little each on the problem a little obstacle, off they go, and that's gone. Not Jim. He could be dogged when he had an issue. And also he had another characteristic that's rare amongst other scientist colleagues, which is that he had an open mind, wanted to make sense. Not just having an open mind is not sufficient. Wanting to correlate things that you're open to understanding, correlate them to see if there is possibility of a genuine understanding. And Gene was like that, you know. That's a very rare ability and characteristic, you know. I can count on my hand the few scientists that have either taught me or I became friends with that have that characteristic, you know.
He seemed to be the type of person that was okay with being wrong and then learning from that.
Mm-hmm. He was not afraid to make questions. He was not afraid of appearing to be wrong, as long as somebody came to pointing out what was that he was missing in his argument, if he was missing anything, you know. So, yeah, terrible personal loss and a terrible loss to the world of science, in my view.
I totally agree, Dr. Correa. I didn't know a lot of what you described there, and I learned about Dr. Matlov through interviews with Dr. Judy Wood, a colleague, Russ Gerst, and some others. And then I found the interview on Coast to Coast that I think you have partial transcripts on the EugeneMatlov.com site. That's how also I found out about your work.
Interesting. Led there by Gene Matlov. You were led there by Gene Matlov.
Dr. Correa, your paper reviewing Nikola Tesla's main milestones, inventions, discoveries, and theories is a remarkable evaluation and important testimony to his drive and brilliance. The question is presented in your paper, have the physics of electricity gone beyond Tesla? I suspect not, in what has been publicly released and acknowledged. And this, I suspect, as you described, to identify the fine structure of the electron. This had taken nearly a century of work, yet your work in this fundamental discovery was ignored for two decades. This is where Dr. Eugene Matlov realized what you and Alexandra had done. In a section of the paper, you address Tesla's wireless electricity demonstration at the Chicago World Fair in 1893. We only have 10 minutes left in the interview, but would you tell listeners about this demonstration? What came of it?
There's many aspects to it. In essence, Tesla has already demonstrated that if you have a Tesla coil as an emitter and you put a receiver or receivers at a distance connected to the ground, and the receiver has the same impedance and resonant characteristics as that of the emitter, then you can capture through the ground basically virtually the entirety of the power that you spent in the emission. This was something that he described in several of his lectures, and there are pictures of the event, and of course many movies have, you know, mythologized this situation. But in Chicago in 1893, what he was doing was using the same principles, but also transmitting directly, as you said, across the air. That is only possible to some extent within a limited distance. We have done that here in the lab to the outside. The fact is, once you start to put significant distances in that transmission, it does not show the same kind of fidelity that the ground transmission experiments show. And as you said quite rightly earlier, Tesla went on to think that he could use lightning as a form of transmission. He gave up on it. It was very difficult to control, as you mentioned, that we described in our report, this JAR paper that you were talking about, Journal of Electrometric Research, and that he then thought about doing it at the upper part of the troposphere. Of course, he could not reach there, so but it appears in one of his, actually in two of his patents. He didn't really know if he would be transmitting on the heavy side layer or what today is called the E layer. But, you know, there was hope in his mind that perhaps power could be transmitted that far out on the edge of the atmosphere. The question is sort of complicated because it requires, in effect, the engineering of an ambipolar carrier. Without the carrier, the so-called action at a distance is not going to occur. Or if it does and the carrier is absorbed, then it's limited. I mean, even today's electromagnetic means using maser and laser type beams that are being applied to military purpose, they don't go that far, you know. 100 yards, 300 yards tops, the beam starts to splay out, and of course the underlying ambipolar field is more than resorbed. So the question is, how can we actually transmit the field at a distance so that in the in-between, in the distance that it travels, it does not produce demonstrable effects only at the target, only at the receiver? Well, nobody's ever cracked that one, not even Nikola Tesla, of course. But it has to do with the engineering of ambipolar energy, and obviously has to do with the engineering of ambipolar energy at such high energies that are similar to the energies that we don't measure and cannot measure, but are responsible for, let's say, the gravitational field of astrophysical bodies. Because in a very real sense, what we call gravity is a manifestation, one amongst others, of ambipolar radiation. It's actually an electric phenomenon or process. I was going to mention earlier when you asked about ambipolar energy, what a mathematician, a French mathematician, his name was Aimé Michel, and he was a very good friend of a French Air Force lieutenant called Jean-Michel Plantier, who wrote a very interesting article on the topic of UFO propulsion back in the late 50s in a publication of the French Armed Forces. Aimé Michel, commenting on the Plantier's paper, he said something to this effect, which is described in one of our papers, the actual quotation, but I'm going to paraphrase it, that what Plantier was demonstrating was that there had to be some other form of energy that Plantier called cosmic, which in appearance, phenomenologically speaking, was neither electric nor magnetic, and whose effects, however, could be detected as being electrical and gravitational. So he was actually on the track towards suspicion of an ambipolar energy, a different form of energy that is electric and mass-free and does not phenomenologically produce electric and magnetic effects, not when we are measuring it directly, but indirectly produces, of course, old kinetic effects associated with mass-bound charges, and those kinetic effects are clearly what our physics calls electric and magnetic. In other words, the electric and magnetic properties of this radiation are occluded. They are not evident. So that's what Aimé Michel was after. Well, effectively, you know, Tesla, without being able to make the proper physical theory of this ambipolar radiation, what became known before our work as, you know, Tesla waves or Tesla radiation, was ambipolar. So his transmissions across the air were about transmitting ambipolar energy across the air, just like his transmissions across the ground was about transmitting ambipolar currents through the ground. In a very real sense, whether he made the right theory or not of it. He invented the basic apparatuses that demonstrate the presence of ambipolar radiation. And as I said earlier, you know, when you apply an electric field on a vacuum tube or across an accelerator, that field is not a disembodied entity that has no energetic existence, you know, and also consumes no power. Of course it does. Yeah, and that field is, in fact, a stream of ambipolar radiation that establishes the electric gradient of, you know, a reactor, an accelerator, and so on. So,
Dr. Correa, you've been very gracious and patient and explaining the details of physics that I'm not going to fully comprehend at this moment. The passion you and your wife, Alexandra, have for continually fine-tuning the language of physics and publishing the work for the future of mankind is phenomenal. Not only are you all incredible scientists, but you have the gift of articulating the details of your work and vital critiques of others. Dr. Correa, you're the research and design director of the Aurora Biophysics Research Institute, a biophysicist, molecular biologist, hematologist, political science author, and inventor. Thank you again for being on In Other News. It was an honor.
You're most welcome. Let me just say one thing. None of this work in the past 25 years would have been possible without the collaboration and participation of our dear friend, Dr. Malgosia Ascanas, who's the editor of our websites and a co-author of many of our publications. So it has been a work at SRI. Now, there was a time in which other dear friends, now departed, were part of it, like Dr. Rui Silver, Dr. Jean Malov, Mr. Uri Sudak. We were a very tight group back then. We never lost sight of our objective. So thank you very much for having allowed me to discuss all these strange matters in science and also in our collective living.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.